Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. In this programme, we'll be mostly discussing dark matter, how embarrassing the Earth is to other planets, aliens, nanotechnology and carrot mobs.
You do get boycotts happen, but then they're seen as quite negative. And I think this is the first time that it's been a really serious attempt to do it positively and try and organise consumers around kind of buying positively.
We've dispatched one of the podcast's finest minds and beards on a reproductive mission to the States.
The major group this will help are young cancer victims who will be rendered sterile by what is otherwise curative treatment of chemotherapy and radiation. But also, women are putting off childbearing until they're older. And many of them have run out of eggs by then, or at least have run out of fertile eggs by then.
One of the most prolific science writers of our time, John Gribben, joins us in the studio. And naturally, we'll be chewing over Darwin's beard. And we pay tribute to the little robot that's died on Mars. No, not that one. The Phoenix lander's frozen to death. But what were its last words?
0101010.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello, everyone. Joining me in the studio this week are science correspondents Ian Sample and, back from his reproductive exploits, James Randerson. I don't write this stuff, you know. Nell Bowes is also here. And despite being from the arts desk here at The Guardian, it's safe to say her real passion is science. Welcome, team.
Hello.
Hi.
This week's special guest, though, is astrophysicist and author John Gribben. Hello, John.
Hi, good to be here.
He's perhaps best known for his book on quantum physics, In Search of Schrödinger's Cat. But he's written more than 100 in total on everything from chaos theory to astronomy. His latest book is A History of Astronomy, written with his wife, Mary Gribben. John, as I said, you've written 100 books, everything under the sun covered under those. But this book is about probably your passion, astronomy. How did it come together?
Well, it's not really a history of astronomy. It's more about what's happening now, what we think we understand about the universe today. And I did train as an astronomer originally, well, theoretical astronomer. So it has always been a passion. This particular one came about because we were asked to do it, which was very nice. The old observatory at Greenwich has recently been refurbished. It's got a new planetarium and they're sort of gearing up all their sort of public activities. And they realised that they didn't have a sort of standard guide to the universe, which all self-respecting observatories ought to have. So they asked us to write
one. So this is the Greenwich Observatory's official standard guide to the universe?
Pretty much, yeah.
As books about science history tend to, it begins with the Greeks. And I suppose this is one science, in inverted commas, which connects us directly with the Greeks because they were fascinated by this stuff.
Yes, it does. I mean, we wanted to put it in a historical context and really talk about the fact that very little happened from the time of the Greeks to the time of Galileo, to put it very simply. People thought that the Earth was the centre of the universe and then they discovered that it's not. And that was the big concern. Conceptual leap, and there has been a constant progression of this, what you might call the Copernican revolution or principle, of the Earth being an average place. And we learn and make clear in the book that the Earth is an average kind of planet, that it's in an average kind of galaxy, and that the universe itself doesn't seem to be particularly special, except that it's the place we live.
So astronomy is all about good pictures, but also telling us how average we basically
about
life.
There's a principle. I mean, it's called the principle of terrestrial mediocrity, which says that we're pretty boring.
James is anything but mediocre. What's your question?
Because it's so obvious to us today, having seen images of the Earth from space, that, you know, we live on a spherical planet that goes around the sun. All of those ideas are so familiar to us. And so trying to get my head around someone who broke through the idea that the Earth is obviously flat is just, you know, marvellous. I mean, how did those people go about it?
Well, this link between science and technology, and especially astronomy and technology, is very powerful, and it runs right through. I mean, the developments happened when they did because of the technology, and then later on, better telescopes, radio telescopes, satellites and so on, that all adds to it. But it was very difficult even for someone like Galileo to appreciate the truth of the situation in the universe. As a good example of this, he realised that what we now think of as Newton's law, that things keep moving in a straight line unless they're acted upon by a force, meant that if you didn't allow for friction, that if you rolled a ball along, it would keep rolling forever. And he knew that the Earth was round, And so he thought that that meant that the natural path of a ball rolling along the surface of the Earth was to go in a circle, what we'd call an orbit. He didn't know about gravity. He thought that was the natural path of things left alone in space, was to follow circles, because he couldn't take that extra leap out and realise that out in space things would travel in straight lines. So even a genius, you know, with inadequate information can't make progress. And the counter
for us.
There is. the counter to that is when we get into the 20th century, I think it was Paul Dirac, great quantum physicist, said in the 1920s that at that time it was easy even for an average intelligence to make great breakthroughs because there was so much new information coming from the technology. Mind you, he was a genius.
John, you were touching on how there's this consistent desire among humans to place themselves somewhere special in the universe and to be at the top of some imaginary sort of pinnacle somewhere. But we do seem to occupy this sort of Goldilocks region of space, at least for carbon-based life. Do you think there are other regions of space out there which are just ripe but for other types of life?
Very much so, but there is a ray of hope for us being special in some sense. And this is not something that is received scientific wisdom. This is very much my own view, although there are other scientists believe the same sort of thing. I think that life is likely to be very common in the sense that there are lots of other planets rather like the Earth, orbiting stars rather like the Sun, and very probably with life forms and probably carbon-based, because we know a lot about the chemistry of interstellar space, the kind of things you find in space. There are very complex molecules, almost up to amino acids. Mm. And any young planet that's got water on, this stuff's going to rain down from cosmic debris. I think it's easy to get life started on a planet like the Earth. But I think intelligent life and our kind of technological intelligence may be very rare indeed. So we may be special because we are possibly, I hate to use the word advanced because we make many horrible mistakes, but in the everyday use, we may be the most advanced civilization in the galaxy.
And what is it that gives us that extra edge? I mean, a lot of people will say, yes, there may be life out there, but probably very basic. What went right for us?
The simple answer is the moon, I think. There are various factors which make the Earth unusual, but the single one is the big moon. And the moon was formed in an impact, we believe, when the Earth was young. And the Earth at that time would have had a very thick crust and a very thick atmosphere, probably. And it was struck by an object about the size of Mars. And in this, the whole surface of the Earth was melted and bits splashed out into space. And the bits that splashed out into space, some of them coalesced to form the moon. And it left the Earth with a very thin crust. And it's that thin crust which makes it possible to have plate tectonic activity and volcanoes and earthquakes. And it also, because there's a lot of water around, helped to thin the atmosphere by absorbing carbon dioxide. And then the moon does something else as well. It stabilizes the Earth. It stops the Earth toppling over because it's spinning and wobbling. And Mars actually tips up through 90 degrees from time to time, and that would be pretty disastrous. You know, if the Earth tipped over by 90 degrees, it wouldn't be good for civilization. So I think for many reasons, and more than just those few I've said, the presence of a very large moon is instrumental in making the Earth a stable home for life forms to have a long, stable period of geological time to develop intelligence.
Well, thank goodness for the moon. Well, we'll leave that there for now. John's book is called From Here to Infinity, and it's published by the Royal Observatory Greenwich, and it's out now. With a look at some of the other science stories around this week, here's Nell and Ian with the News Jam.
News Jam.
Google has applied its huge data collecting power to the prediction of the spread of disease. It's launched a new site that claims to be able to raise the alarm over flu outbreaks up to 2 weeks in advance of existing public services. Google Flu Trends takes the general search tracking technology pioneered by Google Trends and applies it specifically to influenza.
Leading experts are warning the government that it must begin a major and urgent effort to assess the safety of nanomaterials. They include the tiny particles commonly used in products as varied as sun cream, sports clothing and medicine. Hundreds of consumer products made with nanoparticles, which can be 100 times smaller than a virus, are already on the market, despite an almost complete lack of knowledge of the dangers they may pose to human health and the environment.
Scientists have reported the discovery of a gene that increases the chances of becoming hooked on cocaine. A study has found addicts were 25% more likely to carry the variant than people who did not use the drug. The discovery is unlikely to lead to a treatment for cocaine addicts, but scientists hope it could be used to screen for those most likely to have problems kicking the habit if they ever try the drug.
And the headline to this story is worth its coverage alone. Darwin's Heir discovers Darwin's hair. The Natural History Museum's Darwin exhibition has opened. Some keepsakes have gone on display for the first time, including loose hairs taken from his study after his death, actually from his beard. They were carefully wrapped in tissue, marked remaining hair and placed in an envelope. The exhibition is the highlight of Darwin 200, a national programme of events celebrating Charles Darwin's ideas, impact and influence around the 200th anniversary of his birth.
Nell and Ian, thanks very much. Let's talk about some of those stories. Nanotechnology. John Lawton chairs the Royal Commission on the Environmental Pollution, which carried out the investigation we heard about.
The issues become a bit more tricky when you move to what are called third and fourth generation nanomaterials, which are nowhere near in commercial use yet, but people are thinking about it, where you might, for example, combine some kind of microelectronic device with some biological interactions of the kind you might find in a living biological cell, for example, in an extremely, almost unthinkable kind of new computing process.
John Lawton there. Ian, you wrote this story. Tell us a bit about this. I mean, listening to media coverage on this last week, you would have thought that suddenly the Royal Commission has found all sorts of evidence that nanotechnology is destroying our cells, but that's not the case.
No, they were very clear that they found no evidence of harm, but then they stressed immediately afterwards that's because there's very little data out there and not a lot of testing and monitoring going on to look for it, to be honest. When I first went along and heard about this report, I sort of eyes rolled a little bit because the Royal Society, the Royal Academy of Engineering, came out with an extensive report looking at exactly the same thing 4 years ago. And other reports have come out since, and you think, well, this is yet more people saying that there may potentially be dangers with nanotechnology. They were a lot stronger than any of the previous reports, in my view, in terms of what they said. They are pushing the same lines, but they're saying that, you know, we really do need to crack on and get the tests in place and get the sort of environmental monitoring in place, because this stuff will get into the environment. So we need to know if there is reason for concern.
John, is it right that scientists are taking a precautionary approach to this? Is it that they're genuinely concerned, or is it that they don't want to be caught out by members of the public later saying, why didn't we think about this before?
It's probably a bit of both, but I think that it probably is a natural sense of caution. I think the scientific community are much more cautious than many members of the public appreciate, and they don't tend to go around in sort of bloodstained white coats letting viruses out into the world just for the hell of it to see what happens.
Apart from in films. We'll move on to something a bit more frivolous now. Well, sort of semi-frivolous. Beards. It's James's favourite subject.
I'm hoping that we're now going to clone Darwin from his beard.
So that's right, actually. The mouse that was cloned last week from the frozen embryo, you know. It could happen. Ian, let's talk about, seriously, the Darwin 200 exhibits, though. What's in it? You know, what's it like?
Well, I think what's more important than actually Darwin's body of work was that I was trying to convince the Natural History Museum yesterday to create full Darwin beards for Christmas for their shop. I think
properly cloned, you mean?
Well, no, I think it would be a good thing. I mean, as soon as I heard Darwin's beard, as I was told it was going to be on show, I said, well, obvious question, am I allowed to wear it? But no, it's only a few fragments in a piece of tissue.
And that's a great idea. It could be like a Father Christmas replacement for non-believers.
Well, I thought it would be something akin to what sort of Dawkins and Dennett failed spectacularly with on the sort of the Brights front of a sign of
that's right, you know,
well, we'd have being, to wander being around with enormous
a believer
bits,
in evolutionary
bits.
Theory and, you know, possibly even having atheistic
all right
tones.
Let's stay away from
brings
that
a whole new sense to November,
but
doesn't it?
My question simply was in this exhibit at the Natural History Museum, you know, what kind of stuff can visitors expect to see?
But you've got personal letters, his personal notebooks, his first editions of Origin of Species. They have the two mockingbirds from two different islands in the Galapagos, which you can see specific differences between them, which you wouldn't see in a mainland colony of mockingbirds. And these were the variations that, you know, seed that idea of natural selection.
That's right. It's these mockingbirds rather than the finches, which actually seed the idea, which is the finches of the myth.
Yeah. One of the things I really liked was an open notebook of his, which is reasonably well known, but it's drawn across the top and underlined. It says, this is the question. And on the left-hand side, he's written the word marry, underlined. On the right-hand side, not marry, underlined. And then he has what his life will be like if he does marry on the left and what his life will be like if he doesn't on the right. And and there's this brilliant thing about, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but it's something along the lines of someone to play with, dash, better than a dog anyway. and on the right has, you know, no children in brackets, no second life. But what was actually really touching? He was grappling with this. He said, you know, if I get married, this enormous loss of time that I'll experience, and obviously children will cost money. And he's a pragmatic lover, this man.
On the marriage side, it says less money for books.
Yeah, yeah. But at the bottom of that left-hand page, it's really struck me. It just says, marry, full stop, marry, full stop, marry, full stop.
Well, anyway, there's more of all this stuff at guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly.
The American Society for Reproductive Medicine held its annual meeting last week in San Francisco, and our man James Randerson was there to watch in all its glorious, gory detail. One of the most interesting announcements was the birth of a baby after the first ovary transplant. James is here to explain everything, but first let's hear from the man who carried out the procedure.
I'm Dr. Sherman Silber, and I'm the director of the Infertility Center of St. Louis at St. Luke's Hospital in St. Louis, Missouri.
You're here to talk about this first ovary transplant and the successful pregnancy that's ensued from it. First of all, could you tell us a little bit about the patient themselves and their history?
The recipient is, she lives in London. She was originally a German citizen, but she's English now. And her donor, an identical twin sister, lives in Vancouver. So when they came to St. Louis in the center of the U.S. to have this surgery, it was kind of a reunion, actually. But the recipient went through menopause in her early teen years and has had no ovarian function. And she came to see us when she was in her late 30s. And with 20 years of no ovarian function, severe osteoporosis, and her sister had offered to donate her ovary to her. And since they were identical twins, we didn't have to worry about rejection.
And also any pregnancy that comes from this, any child would be genetically equivalent to a child that the donor had themselves.
Yeah, it would be it's genetically identical to the recipient. Now, it's true it came from the donor ovary, but because their DNA was identical, and we tested that with DNA fingerprinting, then the DNA of the child would be no different than if there was no ovary donation involved.
Okay, so tell us a bit about the procedure itself, because it's really a surgical tour de force.
I'm embarrassed to say that, but I think it really is true. We've had experience going back 40 years doing microsurgery with these tiny little blood vessels, thousands of rats and mice doing ovary and kidney transplants and heart transplants on these little mice and rats, as well as, over 30 years of experience with humans doing microsurgery. So that was good preparation for being able to do this procedure. We were well equipped to do it, uniquely equipped to do it. But and so we're very excited. Putting together little blood vessels that are as thin as a human hair and having it work really well right away. But I do want to point out that we know that there aren't going to be many centers in the world that are going to do this kind of microsurgery. But subsequently, we really have developed simpler methods that will be applicable everywhere that I believe will work just as well.
So she's given birth now. And is this really the first one?
Well, yes and no. She delivered last week, actually, by C-section. Everything apparently has gone well, so that's all good. But Sherman Silber has done this sort of thing before. 4 years ago, he performed the first partial ovary transplant, which is taking strips of tissue, grafting them onto an existing ovary. And there have actually been 8 successful births using that technique. This is the first time that he's used a full ovary.
And would it only work for women with twin sisters?
Well, yeah, I mean, the reason, obviously, he's done it with twin sisters is, well, there are two reasons, really. One, that you can avoid the rejection problems, obviously, because the donor and recipient are genetically identical. She doesn't have to take drugs for the rest of her life to prevent rejection of the organ. But also, because the organ is genetically identical, it means that she's effectively having her own children. If you donated an ovary from someone else, then you'd be having someone else's children. You could do it with people who were not twin sisters. It'd be easier with sisters because they'd be a little bit closer. But of course, for that reason, you probably wouldn't want to, because you know, you'd be having someone else's children. But the main reason for doing it really is for women who want to delay reproduction for some reason. Now, in the case of someone who's about to have cancer therapy, their fertility is going to be damaged by the drugs they take, chemotherapy, radiotherapy. And so that would be one reason you take the ovary, freeze it, and then reimplant it later on. Silber is also saying that you could use it for women who might want to delay reproduction for other reasons, perhaps because they're too busy with their careers to have children. But I'm very, very dubious that anyone would want to go through such a kind of fundamental procedure just for that reason, particularly since there are other options, just freezing your eggs and using them later.
Well, another key development was good news for IVF from frozen embryos.
Well, I spoke to Selina Cancel-Calra, but there were actually three different studies at the conference that were looking into this.
We found a couple of interesting things. The first being that multiple pregnancy was much more likely following transfer of frozen embryos. So approximately 76% of all pregnancies conceived after frozen embryo transfer were singleton pregnancies, compared to just 60% in following fresh embryo transfer. Correspondingly, there was an increase in twin pregnancy following transfer of fresh embryos with about a twofold increase risk. And we know that the primary determinant of morbidity in anything we do is multiple pregnancies.
It's quite good news because it's suggesting that freezing embryos is not a bad thing for them. And in fact, the results with frozen embryos are actually better than with using fresh embryos in IVF. That means when you take the drugs or you give the drugs to the mother to release lots of eggs to use, you then create the embryos in the lab and implant them. Now, with a fresh cycle, you put them back pretty much straight away, but with a frozen cycle, you can wait for a while. And this research is suggesting that actually waiting is quite a good idea, probably because all the hormones get to settle down before the pregnancy starts.
For everything you need to know about this subject, again, head to guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Still to come, choose your weapon. Which is better at defeating climate change, a carrot or a stick? Plus, why in space no one can hear your teeth chatter?
I'm resting a lot, but still communicating with organers once per day. Still hoping to get a bit of strength back and maybe do more science.
A great response to last week's special podcast on what Barack Obama means for science. Here are some of your comments, starting with our Facebook wall.
This is from Rachel Kirkham, who comes from Tunbridge Wells Girls Grammar School. I enjoyed the comprehensive Barack Obama podcast. I think the most interesting research that could affect climate change is the utilisation of quantum noise to increase solar panel efficiency. Let's hope progress gets back on track. On the blog, we had some stuff that we didn't really understand, but some top contributions too, thanks. So here are some of them. Terrible lyricist on climate change. We're going to have to accept a grim reality that we're in the earliest stages of an extinction event, perhaps the sharpest the planet has seen since the KT event more than 60 million years ago. The human impact on the Earth simply has to lessen, or our children's future will be terrible.
A couple from the States now. Les says it's depressing you guys care more about American science than many Americans. One from Dan that producer Andy wants us to put in. The editing is terrific. Is terrific. Ting it terrific. Riffic.
Despite the highbrow nature of the discussion on the podcast, DJ 2257 decides to pick up on a line in the intro when Alok pondered, what is the collective noun for a group of Guardian journalists? Oh, he's a man after my own heart. They suggested sheep. Willy-minded liberal replied to that, no, no, that's the collective noun for Daily Mail readers. Surely the one for Grawniad journalists is a typo. Great suggestion. We've forwarded on to the powers that be. No doubt the newspaper and website will be adopting that group noun forthwith. And if you have any others, do of course send them in.
Surely it's a sandal of Guardian.
A yoghurt.
A lentil. Tom Trottier from Ottawa wrote, 918 Facebook members getting close to four digits. At the time of recording, it was a humongous 928 members, slowly rocketing towards the magical number. Tell your friends, folks, the 1,000th member gets an Alok Jha signed copy of something on his desk.
I do like the typo of Guardian journalist, though. I think we should adopt that as the house style. I think it's fantastic. Well, anyway, join our Facebook group and post comments on that wall, or leave us a comment on the blog if you like. That's all at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. There are a number of novel ideas on how to curb the effects of climate change. Use renewable forms of energy, fill the oceans with iron, move to another planet. Well, here's another, carrots. Well, kind of. Rather than using a metaphorical stick to change people's behaviour, campaigners are trying to increase energy efficiency through consumer power, dangling a carrot in front of local businesses. Our very own James Randerson was out shopping in London's Covent Garden with his microphone when he bumped into the carrot mob.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Lewish, and with my colleague Annesley, we're the organisers of the second UK carrot mob. It's a fun, positive consumer action where basically what we do is we all go to a local business, such as tonight we're going to a kind of mini market, a food and wine shop, and we all spend some money, and the business agrees to spend a certain percentage of that on making themselves more environmentally friendly, making themselves more energy efficient. They've pledged to spend 35% of whatever we spend this evening on making their store more energy efficient.
And then what sort of thing, do they sort of specify what they're going to do?
They're particularly looking at refrigeration, because as you can see, they're already using fluorescent light bulbs and things at the moment, so that's all quite efficient already. But they're looking at upgrading their old fridges to newer, more energy efficient models.
And how do you sort of verify if they, you know, whether they spend the money on what they say they're going to?
Well, we actually work with them. We're going to get some environmental assessors in after the event to help them spend that money most effectively and make sure that they actually go through with it and there's no problems.
And what? How often do these events sort of happen, and how do you let people know about them?
Well, we actually organised one, the first one, about a month ago now. We mostly promote it through email lists and online. We've got a website, carrotmobuk.org, and a Facebook group. So mainly spread through kind of word of mouth through environmental networks, and then word of mouth to people's housemates and friends and relatives.
Have you bought anything?
I haven't yet. I'm saving it up. I'm going to go in there and do my monthly shop in a minute.
Good stuff. Thanks very much.
I'm Dominic. I like the idea. I think it's a nice movement, and somewhat the carrot mobbing movement, because it's make you aware of your consumer power, that you can change things through your way of buying things, when you buy and what you buy.
No, what are you going to buy when you go in there?
I've got a shopping list from friends that could not come. So some wine and flour, whatever. I've got like 5-6 things to buy. And toothpaste.
I've been involved in the movement, these kind of movements, for years, and they've kind of maybe gradually come of age. You do get boycotts happen, but then they're seen as quite negative. And I think this is the first time that I know of that it's been a really serious attempt to do it positively and try and organise consumers around kind of buying positively. So I think that's partly why I really support it, because it kind of gives it that very positive and kind of exciting edge, rather than the kind of the negative publicity of, let's try and, you know, change the company and bring it down or whatever.
So what's your name?
Rain.
And why are you here?
I don't know, I just thought I was going to a talk, but I really didn't read the website.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Main engine start. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff of the Delta II rocket with Phoenix, a distant science outpost seeking clues of the evolution at the polar region of Mars.
The vehicle is responding.
And finally, a tribute to a science great. Phoenix, the Mars lander, has gone to the big experiment in the sky.
The team has me on extreme bed rest to recharge power supply. There is cautious optimism about pulling out of this in a few days.
The plucky robot blasted off from Earth last year and landed on Mars this May.
In case we don't get this chance again, thank you all so much for the questions, comments and good wishes over the mission. It's been awesome.
It's been keeping everyone updated on its progress throughout by little text messages or tweets.
I'm resting a lot, but still communicating with organers once per day. Still hoping to get a bit of strength back and maybe do more science.
But alas, it's twittering no more. The bitter Martian chill has finally brought it to the end of its mission, having almost doubled its planned operational life of 3 months.
It's very unlikely I'll wake up next spring, but if I do, I'll call home.
That was one of the last messages from Mars rover Phoenix. Let's leave a moment for everyone to sort of digest that. James, what did it actually achieve in terms of results and so on?
Well, I guess the most eye-catching thing was the discovery and the tasting, if you like, of water ice on Mars, which we kind of pretty much knew was there, but it was nice to be able to confirm it. It did chemical analysis of the surface. It took over 25,000 images. It used an atomic force microscope, which is the first time that's been used off the Earth. And there was the slightly puzzling discovery of perchlorate as well.
John, how important are things like the Phoenix and so on to the work that astrophysicists are doing, astronomers are doing? At this stage, all the information we've been reporting is kind of primary data, the fact that they've discovered water ice and so on. But how useful is it for astronomers?
I am very ambivalent about all these kinds of projects because I've got, at one level, I was sort of brought up on science fiction and I think it's great and we should go out there and explore and do wonderful things. And at another level, I think there are more important things that we should devote limited resources to, like we've been mentioning climate change, you know, what use is going to Mars going to be for real problems that are facing humankind. But as far as the specifics are concerned about understanding what we learn from a probe like this, it's too early to say. My view is that you need to wait and get it digested and get some more complete package of results coming out. And then you'll find that the stuff will come out and the public will have forgotten about it and it won't get the publicity it deserves.
So there's more to come, scientific papers-wise, and more digestion and things.
Much, much more to come.
It's interesting, earlier on we were talking, I mean, it costs about $400 million. Ian, you didn't think that was money well spent?
Well, no, I didn't go that far. I was just quite keen to know what Phoenix had found, because I think you really need to know all of that. And as John was saying, it may take a long time before that really comes out and people really appreciate what it found up there. Before you can really start thinking, was that money well spent? I mean, I'm a huge advocate of space exploration, manned and using robotic probes like this. And it did seem to, you know, just be brilliant in terms of the technology. They seemed to really nail down the technology, at least for the landing. They had some problems getting soil samples into the ovens, of course, which cause a lot of problems, actually. So I think that the technological hurdles they faced and they overcome it came in many cases was good, and that's what this is all about. But how do you judge whether that money's worth it? I think that's incredibly hard to do.
I think you have to look at something else as well. I mean, I may have been a bit negative before. I think possibly the most important thing about a probe like this is that it will encourage a lot of people to get excited about science and space, and it'll make more people study it at school, university, and so on.
It has done as well because of the whole Twittering thing, the whole blogging thing. There's been a huge community around it, and $400 million, it's only about 10 cruise missiles anyway.
Well, so compare it with what they spend on making a James Bond movie or something.
I don't know, John, if you'd be able to help with this, but I'd be really exciting if someone had a mission where they would send a few things off to Mars. It would actually try and build up something and have something that you sort of add to over the years over there. So you almost do a sort of remote build-up of a basic research station that you could just gradually build to, and it wouldn't just be this, you know, go there, scrape about on the floor and die in a few months later, which is very good, but maybe something more ongoing.
It's a great idea, but you'd need even better technology to land another lander right next door to the one that's already there.
Without smashing into it.
Okay, well, Phoenix's final Twitter read:
01010100.
And I'm sure I don't need to tell you that that's binary code for triumph.
Mars Phoenix is finally frozen on a Martian Arctic plain. Vinny, Vidi, Fodi.
Her controllers added its epitaph. From the winner of a competition, it read in Latin: I came, I saw, I dug.
Phoenix is no longer communicating with Earth. We'll continue to listen, but it's likely its mission has ended.
Back now to our special guest, astrophysicist and author, John Gribbin. John, picking up from what we were saying earlier about the sort of history of astronomy and the way that we've become more and more mediocre in the universe, the thing that's happened in the past century is a sort of ramp up of how abstract and weird astronomy has become, with things like dark matter, dark energy, the quantum stuff, general relativity, all these things which you can't actually even imagine in your head. So has this sort of been a boon time for astronomy, or has it just been a time when it's become an activity for just a very small number of people?
It's been a boom time. I came along just when things were really going crazy in terms of understanding the universe at large. And when I started out, you know, which is way back in the 60s, it was just after the time when people said that you could get all the cosmologists in the world together in one room and it wouldn't be a very big room. And now you've got, you know, loads and loads of people doing loads of different things. So we've been through, in that sense, a revolution in our understanding of the universe and opening up the whole of the electromagnetic spectrum. You know, in the 50s, we had optical and radio waves, and now we've got X-rays, gamma rays, infrared, telescopes in orbit. So we look at the whole spectrum now. We're just starting to look at gravitational radiation. So in that sense, there can never be the same kind of revolution, because we're already seeing everything that there is to see. And it's going to be a time of consolidation at one level, but at the other level, we're now addressing a whole new series of questions. I mean, people seriously ask the question about whether this is the only universe, for want of a better word, whether there's a multiverse with different universes existing somewhere else in space and time.
Another thing that's happened in astronomy and astrophysics is the bringing together of the cosmology and the very, very, very small. It seems to be that the things like string theory or quantum loop gravity or those kinds of things are being used as explanations of the start of the universe, never mind just what is it that we're all made of.
This is really, really important. I think it's possibly the most profound thing in the whole of science, and not quite at the level of string theory and quantum loop gravity. We can understand what stars are made of and how they work from nuclear physics. We get ages of stars, which come out to be the oldest stars are about 13 billion years. We go to the other extreme and we use gravity and Einstein's theory to work out how old the universe is, and it's 13.8 billion years. And these are numbers which come from opposite ends of physics, the very smallest and the very largest, and they give you the same answer. And that's a really profound indication that the whole of science is working and all the bits fit together and we're not barking up the wrong tree.
John, I was just interested in sort of where the next sort of big leaps in understanding are going to come from. You've talked about sort of this period of consolidation, but we know that astronomers can only really see about, what, 4% of the universe, or 4% of material in the universe. Are there going to be any big sort of big steps coming? And if so, what's going to bring those about?
Well, you're referring, of course, to dark matter and dark energy. And dark matter is relatively boring because it's probably particles, and it may be different kinds of particles from what we're made of, but it's particles. Dark energy is 75% of the universe in energy terms, or E equals MC squared terms. And dark energy, if it is really what we think it is a natural force or process which is making the universe expand faster. Now, this means it's a source of energy. Now, if you're being very optimistic, then in the future, I would not dream of suggesting how far in the future, if we can find out what dark energy is, we can tap into it. If we can tap into it, then as far as human civilization is concerned, we've got an inexhaustible supply of energy, which is not something for nothing, because by tapping into it, we'd be slowing down the rate of the expansion of the universe by some unimaginably small amount, the same as a space probe going to Saturn whizzes past Jupiter and slows down Jupiter by an unimaginably small amount. So there is very long-term hope for an inexhaustible energy supply from what seems on the face of it to be the most abstract waste of time, pure research going.
I think that's the first time I've ever heard anyone talk about dark energy as a source of actual harnessable energy. This is like when people said that black holes could be a source of energy as well.
It's better than that, because it's here. You know, there's dark energy in this room. So
there is dark energy
you don't have to travel 5 or 10 light years to go and find
there's
a black
hole. There's dark energy in this room, every recording studio. That's a perfect place to end. John, thank you very much. John Gribbin's book, From Here to Infinity, is out now. Nell, Ian and James, thank you also. And I'll leave you to go off and do some proper work now. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Don't forget to add your voice to the debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.